May it please the court, good morning. I'm Stephen Cox from Robinson Bradshaw and Henson in Rock Hill, South Carolina. I represent Wachovia Securities, now Wells Fargo Advisors. I'm just going to refer to them as Wachovia for brevity and ease of reference. We're here on appeal from a decision of the District Court of South Carolina to confirm an arbitration award entered in a FINRA arbitration proceeding between Wachovia and four South Carolina residents as respondents. The underlying arbitration involved the departure by those respondents from the Wachovia brokerage house to another brokerage house of Stiefel Nicholas. There were several issues in that underlying arbitration. Wachovia was the claimant. It had brought several claims, such as breach of fiduciary duty and misappropriation of trade secrets related to the respondent's departure. Respondents, in turn, filed a Wage Payment Act counterclaim under the South Carolina Payment of Wages Act. The arbitration panel denied Wachovia's claims on the merits, granted the Wage Payment Act claim on the merits. We are not here today challenging the district court's decision to confirm those portions of the arbitration award. What we are challenging is the district court's decision to confirm and refusal to vacate that portion of the arbitration award that awarded $1.1 million, approximately, in attorney's fees and expenses to the respondents. We come here before this court fully aware of the high hurdle that a petitioner faces when asking a court to vacate an arbitration award. The grounds are narrow. They're specifically enumerated in the Federal Arbitration Act, Section 10A, and they're rare. And the cases are legion in this circuit, in which this circuit and the district courts of this circuit have acknowledged those circumstances are rare. But there are cases where vacatur is appropriate, and this court has not hesitated to act when it is appropriate. Just last year in the Raymond James case, for example, this court vacated an arbitration award when the arbitrators had exceeded their powers.
Could I just clarify, you don't seem to make your 10A4 argument.
No, ma'am. We are not. So
we're just talking 10A3 and whatever remains of manifest regard.
Yes, ma'am. Exactly. I'm glad you mentioned 10A3, Judge Duncan, because that is the case I was about to mention as well, the Marrowbone case of 2000, in which this court vacated an arbitration award because, among other things, the arbitration panel had denied a party a full and fair hearing, a fundamentally fair hearing. Marrowbone and the other cases cited in our brief stand for the proposition that when an arbitration panel denies a party a full and fair hearing on an issue, that is ipso facto grounds for setting aside.
That seems an awfully hard argument to make here when the arbitrator said, what else can we do? What didn't we do? What else can we do?
I think the threshold question, Your Honor, is notice. This claim under the Frivolous Proceedings Act, which is the issue that the principal.
Yes, I understand that, but you were offered an opportunity to at least pursue your argument in further briefing, and you declined. Why would we grant you relief that you didn't seek from the arbitrators?
Well, if I could take issue with just one statement, and that is, I don't know that they necessarily offered briefing. I think what they said was, would a briefing cure that? And the response by the counsel for Wachovia at that hearing was, I don't believe it would because they haven't come forward with evidence first. Essentially, that argument would turn the burden of proof.
Well, even as you articulate it, you took it as an offer.
I don't think we did. I don't believe we took it as an offer.
You responded that you didn't think briefing would help. So apparently you thought that you had the opportunity to pursue briefing as a course of action my only point.
Well, I can't speak for myself because I wasn't the lawyer below. I think Mr. Paduano, the lawyer for Wachovia Securities, his position to the panel was a briefing is sort of beside the point because before there can be any briefing, it's their burden as the party asserting the claim to come forward with notice first. The Frivolous Proceedings Act says it has a comprehensive set of procedural safeguards, and it says the party asserting the claim has to come forward with notice and specific complaints about what they're saying.
That's a different substantive argument. Whether or not you can import all of the procedural impedimenta of a statute into an arbitration proceeding is a slightly different point from the one I'm asking, which is, all of these points are points you could have made in briefing, including the notice argument. You had an opportunity to pursue whatever it is you might have wanted. So this isn't an instance where you were cut off without an opportunity to elaborate on your claim. There was a concern expressed about the very issue that you raised,
right,
and you declined any further opportunity to explore it in that forum.
No, ma'am, I would suggest this is what we did. What we said was, We have to have notice first. It's their burden as the party asserting the claim to come forward with evidence to say what we did wrong under the Frivolous Proceedings Act.
On the second day when the filings were made, what more notice would you have required?
The Frivolous Proceedings Act says that at the conclusion of a proceeding...
But that's a state statute. You're in arbitration. What more notice would you have required of what the issue was that you were supposed to respond to?
Well, ma'am, that's exactly the notice that's required. When this arbitration panel relied on this particular source of statutory law, it necessarily had to give us the due process that statute requires. Our argument is, when a particular source of law says you are guaranteed this due process, they have to give us that due process.
And what's your authority for that?
That's part of the full and fair hearing, that when you have a statute...
No, what is your specific statutory or, more particularly, case law authority that when an arbitration panel looks to a statute to fashion a part of an award, that the entire statute is imported and constrains the arbitrator's authority?
I would assert that first under 10A3... which says that the arbitrators have to give us a fair hearing. The case glosses on 10A3.
But the hearing is not defined, I'm sorry, I think this is...
Please, go ahead, Justice Johnson.
It's my question, too. The hearing isn't defined by the procedural requirements. What is your authority for the proposition that a fair hearing is defined by the external requirements of a state statute?
I hope I'm answering this question. I promise you I'm not trying to dodge it. Arbitrators don't have to give a reason for acting. We all know that. But when they say we're relying on this statute, and that statute says here's the due process you have to be given when you're relying on this statute, that's the due process they have to follow.
And what is your authority for that?
I just think it's common sense, Your Honor. Under the Federal Arbitration Act, when the Federal Arbitration Act says we have to be provided a fundamental and fair hearing, let me ask the question this way. If they hadn't given us notice of any kind or a hearing...
Well, see, now you can go to an extreme. But what if a statute says you're entitled to 20 days' notice and the arbitrators only give you 10? Surely you wouldn't be before a court saying you're entitled to vacater.
I would agree with you. And the reason is...
So how do you distinguish the two cases?
When the nature of due process is such that it is ignored to such an extent that there's no hearing at all, and that's what happened here. We basically said we have to have notice of what we did wrong under this statute, and they haven't given us any specific notice of what we did wrong.
I think it was really... I didn't have any trouble understanding what I read, what they thought you did wrong.
Well, I guess, and a reason I ask that is because the inquiry on the merits of these claims, for example, this was a breach of fiduciary duty, breach of loyalty type case. When an arbitration panel or a court is looking at those claims, it's asking questions like, was a breach of fiduciary duty breach, was a fiduciary duty breach, was there a duty of loyalty breach, those sorts of questions on the merits of those claims. The inquiry under the Frivolous Proceedings Act is a very different inquiry. The inquiry there is not whether there was a breach of fiduciary duty, not whether there was damages.
Did you ask for a separate hearing on fees?
No, ma'am, we did not. In fact, the panel sua sponte asked for information on fees. Wachovia, at the very end of the proceedings, abandoned its earlier request for fees that it had put in its initial pleadings.
The problem you are facing, and I'm following up on Judge Duncan and to some extent Judge Davis's question, is that you started out telling us about the limited review process.
Right.
And that's under the Federal Arbitration Act.
Right.
The Federal Arbitration Act does not require, as Judge Duncan has been pointing out, the arbitrators to apply South Carolina procedural law. And I don't know of any case that says that that's what happens. Otherwise, you get into the whole morass of gutting out the whole purpose of arbitration, and you'd fall into this abyss of dealing with state law. Did you comply with this notice provision? The question is, was it fundamentally fair? And here you've got clear evidence from yours, it seems like they didn't refuse to postpone the hearing, did they? They didn't refuse you an opportunity to brief. They didn't refuse to hear any evidence in this matter. I mean, so what is it? I don't know of any other behavior that you're saying they exhibited that would indicate fundamentally unfair under the Federal Arbitration Act. Now, I grant you, if we go into that world of the South Carolina law, we could do that analysis.
Right.
but you're going to have to figure out a way to get us there because the act doesn't get us there.
Well, I think you get there on manifest disregard because I think that still survives to an extent as a judicial gloss on 10A3
that
would enable you get
that
there.
That manifest disregard stuff has pretty much been
I agree. It's no doubt it's been attenuated. No question about that.
Even as a judicial gloss, mm-hmm. Let's take it as that. And let's even assume that the state law's requirement that you have to apply them in arbitration. The arbitrator's ruling still has to be in bad faith or so gross as to amount to affirmative misconduct. And it's very hard to see that on facts under which the arbitrators granted you an extension of time that you took upon yourself on a filing deadline, and then said, what more could we do? What more could be done? Would briefing help? And you say, not really.
Well, what we said was, briefing doesn't help yet. We didn't say that word yet. I'm paraphrasing. I acknowledge.
Was it ever clear to the arbitrators what you wanted?
Yes, ma'am. I believe it was.
Apart from the fact that you didn't want to have attorney's fees imposed, but procedurally, what did you ever request that the arbitrators do that they didn't do for you in terms of procedure?
What we requested was the other side, the respondents, if they're going to make a claim on this statute that they've raised on the very last day of the hearing, they have to give us notice and evidence of the specific thing we did wrong under that statute. As I was saying a second ago, I didn't quite get to finish. The inquiry in that statute is not whether the causes of action alleged in the arbitration hearing have been satisfied or not. The inquiry
set
in that...
Set aside that it was a mistake. Set aside the arbitrator... Let's assume, for purposes of my question, that the arbitrators got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't get you anywhere under the FAA. Under the FAA, it has to be bad faith or grossly wrong.
Well, Judge Duncan, I would submit to you that notice is first base. If they haven't given us notice and specific evidence of what we've done wrong, of what we have done wrong under this statute, then there's nothing for us to respond to, and that's the point we made in our brief.
Not addressing my question is, I'm giving you that it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
For purposes of my question,
mm-hmm.
What makes it exponentially wrong for purposes of vacature?
If I understand what you're giving me. You're telling me, okay, assume they got it wrong. They didn't give you the notice you asked for. Mm-hmm. They didn't give you the evidence of what you did wrong. Your Honor, if a party doesn't give us notice and evidence of what we did wrong, we can't respond to it. That's first base. There's no full or fair hearing at all if you don't even get notice of what you did wrong. I hope I sense I'm not answering your question, and I want to really understand it. But I understood you to say, assume they didn't give you notice. That's the sine qua non of due process.
But it's not that, and it's you're not making the argument under due process. You're making the argument under a state statute.
No, ma'am. I'm making the argument that we didn't get a full and fair hearing because we never got notice in the first place. That's the argument I'm making.
As required by the state statute.
As required by general justice. We just didn't get notice, period.
Here, maybe we can come at it this way. Under many fee-shifting types of statutes,
mm-hmm.
that have nothing to do with misbehavior, it's not a sanction. It's just an award of attorney's fees. Okay?
Right.
What would prevent the arbitrators from effectively approaching the issue of attorney's fees in that fashion?
I think that's a good question. If I understand it, it's a good way to look at it. If this was a prevailing party attorney's fee statute, they wouldn't have to give us any notice of anything. You lost, they get attorney's fees.
And so what in federal law would prohibit an arbitration panel from treating this interesting South Carolina statute as if it's simply a shifting fees prevailing party?
Because it's not.
Well, but that takes us back to Judge Duncan's question.
I disagree.
So they got it wrong. But what makes it so wrong that in the context of an arbitration proceeding, we as a federal court get to say, you know, you were just so wrong that we're not going to let this stand.
Let me phrase the question. I think I can answer the question this way.
Right.
Let's say the statute didn't prescribe a particular kind of notice, and it didn't prescribe a 30-day response period, and it didn't prescribe any procedural safeguards at all. Let's say it had none of that.
It said in the interest of justice.
It just said, if a party makes a motion on these bases, the court can find that, these are the bases for awarding fees. Fine. Let's say that's all I had. We didn't even get that. They came to us and they said, basically on the last day of the hearing, everything that's happened in the past year in this arbitration case shows that this claim was baseless. But that's not what the statute talks about. Well, the statute doesn't just say whether the claims are baseless or not. The statute says you have to examine the subjective reason that the lawyer thought he was allowed to bring the claims. It's a subjective focus on the lawyer's own thoughts in bringing the claims, not the merits of the claims objectively.
And why is that anything other than an error of law?
Because we did not get any notice or evidence of those claims. Whether you're using the statute or whether you're using common due process, whatever safeguard, whatever benchmark you use, they invoke this statute on the last day, and they give us no notice or specific evidence whatsoever to say, this is what you did wrong, this is why we want fees.
Thank you. Mr. Cox, you have some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Daugherty?
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Joseph Docker, and I represent the respondents.
And I apologize for mispronouncing your name.
Oh, that's okay. It's only in the Mid-Atlantic they seem to call it that, Docherty, as opposed to Doherty. But thank you for that. This Court...
You're calling this the Mid-Atlantic?
No, it's in the Mid-Atlantic they call it Docherty. Nowhere else in the country do they call it that.
Okay.
And I can't explain why, but it's I'm stuck with it.
We called it that at UNC.
This Court has held that when considering a motion to vacate pursuant to Section 10A3, the Federal Arbitration Act, you can only vacate the arbitration award if the arbitrators refuse to hear pertinent or material evidence and that refusal deprives a party of a fundamentally fair hearing. The District Court in this case correctly held that there was no refusal to hear any pertinent or material evidence and that there was no misconduct, no misbehavior from this arbitration panel that warrants vacater under Section 10A3. The District Court also held that there was no manifest disregard of the law. In this case, Wachovia did receive a full and a fair hearing. Section 10A3, and the panel touched on this with Mr. Cox, Section 10A3 of the FAA does not require arbitrators to follow the procedural steps found in either the Frivolous Civil Proceedings Act, the FCPA, or in any other statute in order to have a fair hearing.
Like, just been on my mind since it was said, and there was some resistance, apparently, to the notion that the South Carolina statute procedural basis should be what we should hold arbitrators to. But in response, the Wachovia counsel indicated he got no notice. I mean, and that's a fundamental due process of violation, it seems. You know, it goes a little bit beyond that. I mean, and in the transcript, the counsel does say it's a complete surprise. Now, I'm not sure what he's referring to when he says it. But wouldn't the fact that you have no notice be sufficient under the Federal Arbitration Act, even subsection 3, in terms of some misconduct, to afford them relief here?
If they truly had gotten no notice, or if the notice wasn't received under the procedures and the timetables that these parties and this panel agreed to, then maybe, if we had pulled it out at the last second and it wasn't part of any procedure. But as the District Court found, they were on notice from the first time we filed an answer that the respondents were seeking to recover their fees as a result of what we believed to be vindictive, improper, and frivolous motives to bring that litigation. They were on notice from the very beginning. They were on notice in an arbitration brief that we filed. We dated it three different times. Then it was such a prevalent issue in this case that the panel in October, at the end of one of the hearings, stopped, and we had a discussion of how we're going to submit both parties' attorney's fees to the panel as evidence. And it was Wachovia that asked this panel, the arbitration panel, to brief the subject and to provide the legal authorities.
The subject being attorney's fees.
Attorney's fees, just attorney's fees.
You asked that. So that would seem to be noticed.
I'm getting there, but I'm laying the foundation for it. So there was an agreement among the parties and an order by the panel that we would submit our legal authorities for both sides for how they believe they're entitled to attorney's fees, because in October of 2009, Wachovia is still representing to the panel and to us that they're seeking their fees as well, and neither side has pleaded in the statement of claim, which is the complaint or the answer, the statutory authorities that they're relying on, because you're not required to under FINRA rules.
This was the October 22nd hearing when the panel asked the parties for accounting or proposal.
That's
regarding attorney's fees.
That's correct. They asked, how are we going to enter into evidence the actual fees that you're both seeking for? And in that discussion, Wachovia asked for the opportunity to brief the legal authorities on which we were seeking our fees. And everybody agreed, and the agreement was that we would submit our legal authorities of what we were relying upon, both sides, the statutory authorities. Neither side had told the panel what those authorities were at this point. On November 23rd. And on November 23rd, we had our brief in hand, and we were prepared to hand that in. And we were prepared to receive for the first time their legal authorities as well. And that's the procedure that this...
And then what happened?
Well, Wachovia wasn't prepared to hand theirs in on the 23rd. We were prepared, and the panel said, well, we can't fix that, so you'll do it tomorrow, which was the day of closing arguments. So we held our brief, and we exchanged them a day later than we were prepared to, and a day later than we were supposed to. And we each got our briefs right before closing argument. I got my brief literally 2 minutes before I gave my closing argument and got to look at it at lunch after my closing argument was finished. And that was the first time I ever saw the legal authorities that they were relying upon. And, yes, it was the first time they saw ours as well. But the notice that we were looking for our attorney's fees because of their frivolous conduct started from the first time we filed a pleading and continued all the way through the end of closing.
With that procedure on October 22nd, nobody asked to file a response brief.
No one asked for it. No one requested it. It wasn't denied. That was the procedure that we agreed upon and the arbitration panel ordered. There was no request for any response briefs. And you know what? Afterwards, when we got the closings, and I would ask the panel to read carefully the record because it doesn't show that they were demanding to receive notice and they were demanding to have bifurcated hearings. It's not what they said in the record.
Is your brief in the record? It's not, is it?
The arbitration, the attorney's fee brief, it is in the record. It's an exhibit to, I'll get you that site. It's an exhibit to the response to the motion to vacate in the district court, at the district court level.
Right.
I'll get you the pages themselves, but it is in there.
I got it.
There wasn't a request. Wachovia never told this panel once that we want you, that we can't defend ourselves to these claims because we don't know what the frivolous conduct is that they're talking about. And I would suggest to this panel that after those 39 days and 6 hours of closing arguments, everybody in that room knew exactly what conduct we were talking about. There was never a request to this panel that they needed to hear the merits case first and then have bifurcated hearings for attorney's fees. They never said that to this panel. They never asked this panel for anything at the end of the closing except for one thing. The one thing that they did ask for in the record, and it's in the record, is they said you shouldn't consider that statute that they give you. And basically suggesting, look at the legal authorities we gave you. Don't look at the legal authorities that they gave you. And another important thing here is the post-trial submission that took place on December 11, 2009. 17 days after they received our brief and the closing arguments, the record was still open. The record's very clear that the panel told both parties that the record was still open, and Mr. Paduano, their trial counsel, acknowledged that the record was still open. They submitted the post-trial submission of more attorney's fees. And in that, they have a letter, and the letter basically states that we reiterate the arguments in our closing and in our brief. They essentially told this panel on December 11th, we're done. We're not asking you to do anything else. We're not asking you to hold hearings or require notices or bifurcate things. We're finished, and we're expecting an award. That is very different than what's been postured to the court in the appeals. We believe that, frankly, they've never raised the request that they say here in front of this arbitration panel. This arbitration panel never denied them any time to on the day of closings to take more time and look at the statutes and respond. It never denied them the right to submit additional briefing on either procedural issues or the merits of the FCPA claim or to file a response brief to the legal authorities that were exchanged. It never denied them the ability to hold additional hearings or to submit additional evidence. This is a panel that said to them when they raised this, what more could be done? That's a quote from the panel. Two of the panel members each said Would a briefing cure this? And the answer was, I don't know. It wasn't yes, it wasn't no, it was I don't know. In order to vacate under Section 10A3, there has to be a finding that this panel committed misconduct. It had wide latitude to set its own procedural requirements in this case. The panel's right. There isn't any case law that says there's no FINRA rule. There's nothing in the FAA. There's nothing in the case law that says that an arbitration panel that's presented with a state statute has to follow all the procedural steps within a statute. The cases are in our brief as to the wide latitude that panels are allowed to have.
But even if that weren't true, would it matter?
We don't believe it would matter, but the reality of it is, I mean, the case law is legion that this panel had the ability to basically do whatever it wanted with the procedures. And you know what? It didn't do anything that wasn't asked. It didn't refuse anything. Nobody asked it to do anything other than ignore our legal authorities and rely upon theirs. That was the only thing it was asked to do. So there is no misconduct on the part of the panel. In addition, it's important to also note there wasn't any prejudice. And I say that because they've got to claim under the case law that a court may vacate an arbitration award only if the arbitrator's refusal to hear pertinent material evidence prejudices the rights of the parties to the arbitration hearings. Well, Covia's sole attempt to explain to the court how it was prejudiced by the fact that it didn't receive this additional hearing that it now says it so desperately needed, was to submit an affidavit by its trial counsel, Mr. Peduano, and that's contained at the appendix at pages 163 through 170. And I responded with an affidavit that's in the appendix at 474 through 478. And in my affidavit, Mr. Peduano's affidavit sets forth 23 arguments of what it is that they would have presented if they were given this additional hearing. And my affidavit goes through and specifically shows, including the PowerPoint slides of Wachovia themselves in the closing, that 22 out of those 23 arguments, they specifically raised and expressly argued in their three-hour closing argument. The only argument that they didn't raise in the closing that they put in the affidavit was an argument that in the arbitration brief that they exchanged with us on November 24th, they said it was a document, a retention agreement that each of the individuals had, that they said specifically that they were not bringing any claims under and did not seek any relief under. So essentially, all the extensive argument that they claimed they would have shown in order to prove that their motives were in good faith, they argued to this panel. They gave them exactly those arguments in their closing. The reality of it is that the reason that Wachovia didn't ask for any additional hearings either at the closing or in the post-trial submission, it had said everything it was going to say. It had nothing else to say. Wachovia suffered no prejudice when it didn't receive the hearings that it never asked for. So in summary, we believe that there is no misconduct on the part of this panel, and there is no basis under Section 10A3 in order to vacate this award. The panel never denied any request that Wachovia made. It never refused any action that Wachovia asked for. It never excluded any evidence that they sought to introduce. And it never refused or deprived them of any hearing that they wanted, at least that they said that they wanted to this panel. No request was denied. It was the panel that said, what more can we do? Or would a briefing cure this? It was Wachovia that then responded in its post-trial submissions that it was resting on the arguments it had already made in its briefs. The parties exchanged the legal authorities on fees at the same time on November 24th, and that was the procedure that was agreed upon of which you would tell the other side what legal authorities you were basing your claims for attorney's fees on. The respondents complied with that procedure, and that was the procedure that was set in this proceeding and agreed to. It wasn't changed by us. We were the ones that were timely. We complied with their agreements. Well, COVID never asked this panel to take any specific action other than to ignore the statute that we cited and just rely upon their brief. It cannot, Wachovia can't complain now that this panel failed to take action that Wachovia never asked for. And after 39 days of hearings, The panel was very clear in their award of what they thought about Wachovia's motives, and they held him accountable. And now, on the basis of a muddled objection, Wachovia is asking you to help them avoid accountability based upon objections that weren't really made and weren't specific, and there was no misconduct and no manifest disregard for the law. We would ask the panel to please affirm the district court's award or order and enforce the arbitration award in this matter.
That affidavit that you mentioned that Wachovia had submitted in an attempt to show the prejudice, where is that in the record?
That is, I will give you the, it's at the joint appendix, pages 163 through 170.
And the only argument you say that they did not already present was which one?
That was an argument where there was retention bonuses that had some non-solicitation clauses in them that they never attempted to enforce. And in their arbitration brief, which is at page joint appendix page 561, they expressly say that as for those agreements, they have not made any claims based on those agreements, or we're not seeking any relief on the basis of those agreements.
Thank you.
Okay. Would this award, including its quantum, be sustained? Or I guess my real question is, you relied on, I think, a four separate sources for the award, or maybe there were five.
Yes, there was a number of different.
Yeah.
Yes.
Would it have made any difference? You think? I realize I'm asking you to speculate. But would it have made any difference had the arbitrators relied on any one or more of the other grounds you assert, either in lieu of the South Carolina statute or in addition to?
No, I don't think it would have made any difference. And frankly, I was surprised that they didn't also find they were entitled to the fees under the trade secret statute for bad faith. I thought that would be more likely an award than the others. And they also have the inherent power of the panel to award fees that they believe that they're
under the
FINRA code. Yes.
So they could have done it on.
They could have done it on multiple for multiple different bases. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Cox, you have some rebuttal time.
As the district court recognized on page 816 of the record, which is a transcript of the motion hearing, Wachovia raised concerns about the process that was being followed as soon as it knew of them. That is, on the last day of oral argument when the attorney's fees briefs were presented.
I'm a little unclear about that because you proposed, as I recall it, at the October 22nd hearing, you proposed the procedure.
I think that.
Or rather, Wachovia asked to submit briefs on the or legal memoranda in support of an award of fees and costs at a date certain, and the process proceeded as you had initially requested. What difference?
Well, the exchange of briefs did. Let me be clear what I'm referring to, okay? What I'm referring to is when we received those briefs and saw for the first time that they were making a claim under the Frivolous Proceedings Act, we objected immediately. And what one of the arbitrators said, as y'all have all acknowledged, is would a briefing cure that? And then on page 570 of the record, Mr. Paduano, who was Wachovia's counsel at the arbitration hearing, said, I don't know. But he went on to say, because the standard and the statute, from what I saw, there's notice and opportunity to be heard. So that means, in other words, we need some evidence. That's why I don't think it's appropriate at the end, after our record is closed, that new issues have been injected. This statute is not referred to in the pleadings. It's not just the element of surprise. It's complete surprise. Recalling Judge Wynn's question, the issue here was they're now making a claim under a statute that says the lawyer had no business bringing this claim in the first place. Not just that the claims are wrong, but
well,
the lawyer had.
In fairness, it sounds like under the statute an objective inquiry, not a subjective one. What a reasonable lawyer.
I would agree with that.
And
you're right.
The request, The memorandum was submitted in response to, it wasn't a new claim, it was the justification. I believe everybody had been seeking attorney's fees.
Yes, ma'am, but I think there's a fundamental difference between saying we're seeking attorney's fees generically on the basis of a conclusory prayer. I would encourage y'all to go back and look at the initial pleadings in the case. In the prayer for relief, it's a generic conclusory prayer for fees. I see them all the time. I've written them sometimes where you just say, I'm seeking attorney's fees for the baseless claims.
Would you be happy if we remanded to the panel to let them award the same amount of fees under FINRA?
That would be an improvement. We'll wait, back up for one moment. I don't think they can award the same amount of fees under FINRA. FINRA carefully circumscribes the power of a panel to award fees. They can't just award fees generally. They can award fees for discovery sanctions and a few other specific things.
What about the Trade Secret Act?
They could have, but they didn't. They expressly said we're denying relief under that act. And as the district court said in the Raymond James case, panel doesn't have to pick the source of law. It doesn't have to tell us why it's doing what it does.
They said they're denying under that act?
They didn't say deny specifically under the act. What they said was we deny all other claims for relief not specifically addressed herein. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to mislead anybody.
Of course not. That's very different from
Yes. Yes. No, they did not specifically call out the act. But there were four bases asserted. They awarded it under the Frivolous Proceedings Act and the Wage Payment Act and denied it under the other two. And they picked the Frivolous Act. That's the one they picked. That's the horse they rode. Having decided to ride that horse, if there's no basis for getting on the horse in the first place, I'm beating this analogy to death, continuing to ride that horse shows their personal views of right and wrong, as the district court said.
What would have been the largest award you think reasonably possible under the Wage Act?
There was about an hour's worth of hearing on the Wage Act. As Mr. Daugherty admitted in the record, most of the case was not about the Wage Act. Few hours of fees and maybe a portion of a hearing session. I think the hearing sessions were, maybe $1,000 a session, maybe a couple of $1,000 max.
That's not our determination, is it, to get into the award and how much it was?
No, sir.
I thought the issue here dealt with whether the Federal Arbitration Act, there was fundamental unfairness here.
Yes, sir. And that's our point.
And that's where Judge Duncan has come with the October 22nd date, where you asked for this briefing. You say it's general briefing, and it arises from that kind of boilerplate language we all litigators use, just say we want attorney's fees. Then you see that it is at some point in time, you do see it. But where do you ask for this to be postponed so that you can, at that point?
The part I just read says we need notice. And once we say we need notice, the burden's on the party asserting the claim to give the notice.
At some point, you have notice when the briefs are submitted.
This was after the briefs were submitted. So after.
And did you ask, at that point when you did get notice, did you ask for a postponement before anything happened?
We never got notice. That's my point. When they gave us these, I would encourage you to read their brief. It's on page 551 of the record. The entire substantive basis for their Frivolous Proceedings Act claim is about a paragraph, and it's the same general, unspecific, vague language.
But you never requested anything more. You've never made these arguments about what you felt would have constituted notice to the arbitrators.
I don't think we can say it any better than. We could write a 35-page brief, of course, but when Mr. Paduano said,
"No, there's a problem with notice," isn't helpful.
When he says there's notice and an opportunity to be heard, we need some evidence. That certainly should be sufficient to say, "Look, panel members, they've raised an entirely new statute here. We need notice. We need evidence for them to proceed." The burden should then have been on either the opposing party or the panel to give us that notice.
You didn't ask for a proceeding to address that.
I don't think we need to. That turns the burden of proof upside down. Once we've said, look, give
us some. But they're not arguing, they're not challenging due process. You are.
Right, and we challenged it here. And even look at the district courts. Even the district court, I think, concluded on page 816 of the record that we had raised concerns about this process at the end. When they raised this statute at the very end and we said there's a notice problem here, we need some evidence, could we have said it more eloquently? Could we have said it more comprehensively? Certainly we could have. But we raised the issue. We said, this is a new statute. We need notice. We need evidence. The ball was then in the panel's court to force them to come up with specific notice before they could proceed.
Of course, the panel had sat through 65 sessions of evidence and argument.
But that's like getting
and had learned an awful lot about Wachovia's motivations and practices and behavior and.
But it's sort of like getting a sip of water from a fire hydrant. They say, "Well, you've seen the evidence. It's been going on for 65 hearing sessions. But now you're seeking relief under this particular act. you can't just summon up the whole 65 hearing sessions and say, go find the notice. It's in there somewhere. Give us the specific things you think support the specific findings of reasonableness under the Act. It's a different inquiry.
And by the way, there was no affirmative claim by the respondents other than the Wage Act claims. Is that right?
I believe that's correct. Yes, sir. I believe.
So you just said there was about an hour devoted to that.
Right.
And so all those other 64 sessions had to do with what Wachovia, as the claimant, was pursuing against these guys.
It had to do with the breach of fiduciary duty and loyalty.
The alleged breach of fiduciary duty, which was an utter failure of proof.
But it did not have—we didn't try the case for 65 days on whether Mr. Paduano had a reasonable basis for bringing the claims.
Well—
Or whether Wachovia did. That's the point I'm trying to make, perhaps not artfully.
Well, they didn't make the award against counsel.
No, they made it against the
party. They made it against Wachovia.
But— The Frivolous Proceedings Act, the test for the under the Frivolous Proceedings Act is whether a reasonable attorney under the circumstances.
And it says the award can be made against the party represented by
right,
that attorney.
But the person...
That's exactly what they did.
The person the panel is supposed to be looking at is the lawyer. Did the lawyer in his mind have a basis? I don't believe
that's
that...
That's not the inquiry.
Okay. I'm sorry. Okay.
That's not the inquiry under the statute. It's not a subjective inquiry under the statute.
But it is an inquiry as to whether a reasonable lawyer would have brought the claim. That's the point I'm making, whether a reasonable lawyer, not a reasonable party. And I don't believe there was any of the 65 days devoted to whether Mr. Paduano had a reasonable basis for bringing the claims. It was all about whether Wachovia did this and whether the other side did that. That's why it's an entirely different inquiry when you're looking under the Frivolous Proceedings Act. And that's the notice we needed and the notice we didn't get. Thank you very much.
We'll come down and greet counsel and proceed directly to the last case.